Can I welcome everyone here to the LSE today? And let me, of course, welcome in particular our distinguished speaker, Chancellor Klima. We're also very pleased to have with us the Austrian ambassador, Mrs. Eva Nabotny, sitting in the front row down here. The Austrian alumni representative has also come, especially for today's meeting, Dr. Wolfgang Kretschmer. Chancellor Klima joined the Austrian government from the private sector in 1992 as a Minister for Public Economy and Transport, in which position he served from 1992 to 1996. In 1996, he became Minister of Finance in the then caretaker government. In January 1997, Viktor Klima became Federal Chancellor of Austria. As a Social Democrat, I believe Chancellor Klima can play a major role in the international restructuring of the centre-left that is now taking place in Europe and elsewhere. Members of the LSE will recall the recent lecture at the school by Fernando Henrique Cardoso, the President of Brazil, with whom I discussed these issues and who later went on to talk about them with Tony Blair. The last visit to the LSE by a senior Austrian member of state was in February 1995, when the LSE had the pleasure of hosting the federal president, Dr. Thomas Klestil. The occasion was the presentation of a bust of Sir Karl Popper by the government of Austria. As part of this visit, the Austrian government, through Mr. Leo Valmer of Casino Austria, made a generous contribution towards the Sir Karl Popper Memorial Fund. We subsequently welcomed Mr. Valmer and the then ambassador, Dr. Georg Hennig, to the school in May 1996. We are very pleased indeed to have these connections further strengthened today. Austria, as many people will know, is taking over the European Union presidency from the British in the second half of 1998. This is the subject of Chancellor Klima's speech here this lunchtime. His speech is called A People's Europe, Goals and Challenges of the Austrian EU Presidency, and I'm very honoured to be able to welcome him to the LSE today, Chancellor Klima.
Thank you very much for the warm welcome, and I'm sure we will find the possibility to support the Sir Karl Popper Fund also in the future, Mr. D. Ladies and gentlemen, the European agenda for the current year has a busy schedule. The opening of talks with new candidates for enlargement, the determination of participants for the common currency, setting up the European Central Bank, fixing the exchange rates, evaluation of employment action plans of member countries, reassessing the employment guidelines in the light of this evaluation, to name just some of the most important matters. Political discussions of these issues quickly leads to technicalities and the details of implementation. Because of the practical difficulties that always arise when something new is accomplished, and we rarely take the time to consider the truly historical dimension of the events on the agenda of the British presidency of the European Union and the following Austrian presidency. We tend to concentrate on the obstacles that still have to overcome rather than the goals ahead of us, and as a result, tend to overlook the enormous chances and the enormous changes that already have taken place. 10 years ago, nobody would have thought that monetary union had any kind of realistic perspective. And the economic and political integration of Eastern Bloc countries was anything but inconceivable. Let me therefore thank you for the invitation for two reasons. Firstly, because I'm honored to give a lecture in such a prestigious school and to such a distinguished audience. Secondly, because of an occasion like this, gives me the opportunity to reflect on the course of events from a more general perspective than I am usually allowed in my day-to-day work. Ladies and gentlemen, my presentation will be about the challenges of the upcoming Austrian presidency of the European Union, focusing on the issues of employment, monetary union, and enlargement. I will try to give you an impression of my country's perspective on these issues, a perspective that is, of course, shaped by the history of my country. Having been at the center of many of the tragedies that afflicted our century, we may have a somewhat stronger sense of the benefits of stability and cooperation of European integration. Having had the prior experience of the empire as a union of diverse nationalities, we may have a better understanding of the need of common ideas and aspirations, the need of a common bond for member countries. But being a small country now, we are also aware of the need of diversity within unity, of our interest not to be dominated by a single country, but also not to be majorized by a larger group in vital questions. You may have guessed from the title of my speech, A People's Europe, that we see the Austrian presidency in a spirit of continuity, a continuity not just because of shared beliefs, but also because the tasks ahead of us are so momentous that they require a steady development. A People's Europe is much more than a slogan. It is a mission that Europe's politicians have to complete if they want the project of European integration ever to be successful. A project that is still seen with a lot of skepticism, not just in your country. Integration is frequently perceived as forcing too much change on a reluctant population. Eurocrats are seen as removed from people's realities. The common market has the image of offering opportunities only for corporations and not for the people. And political discussions about integration is frequently defensive, trying to allay fears at best, and using union rules as scapegoats for unpopular policies at worst. However, we will not get people to love Europe, to identify with the Union, if we do not find very good reasons for them to do so. These can't be purely technocratic reasons, as, for example, the economic efficiency of a common market, or the possibilities of a new dominating currency, or the growth prospects of opening up new markets. One might, of course, argue that loving or just identifying with European integration would be asking too much. That the issues involved are too distant for most people, except maybe for the Eurocrats themselves. That all politics is local, as a famous American politician used to say. This may be true. However, I need to tell you that in a globalized world, local has taken a very different meaning. Most of the issues that are truly important to people, such as finding a good job or having a decent quality of life, are no longer just determined at the local or even the national level. Take, for example, employment. The current level of unemployment is certainly the single biggest failure of the European project so far. The success of further integration will crucially depend depend upon the success of creating more jobs and reducing unemployment. It has taken many years until it has been acknowledged by all member countries that employment policies must have several dimensions. Of course, a national dimension, but also a European and a global dimension. For example, a global dimension because there's a need to agree on common standards for international trade. But international trade based upon minimum social standards, such as a ban on child labor and an acceptance of trade unions. The fight against unemployment also needs a European dimension. We need to fully exploit the potential of the common market in addition to the regulations of deregulating our markets, to liberalize our markets, also with common research and development efforts, with common technical standards, and to some extent, even common infrastructure projects. Just let me give you an example. We need more examples, such as the GSM standard, where a common standard allowed European corporations to develop a technology that is now competitive in global markets. A European dimension, we hope so. A European dimension is also one that exploits the advantages of cooperation, harmonizing those policies. Those policies that countries frequently use as instruments of competition for mobile capital, such as, for example, special tax advantages or low environmental standards. A sensible cooperation on restricting this kind of unfair competition will have long-term benefits for all member countries. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason for why it took so long for unemployment to figure prominently on the European agenda was, in my view, not just the opposition of conservative governments. And with 9 out of 15 countries now being headed by social democratic governments, we have no excuse anymore. I think one of the reasons why we didn't achieve better results was also that the debate was stuck on traditional categories of market versus state that did not really provide any new solutions and only created reflexes of opposition on either side of the camp. Therefore, it was, in my opinion, a wise decision of the Commission and the Luxembourg presidency last year to introduce the instrument of comparing best practices. Given the huge dimension of the problem, as well as the fact that there are no single best solutions, a competition of ideas will be very useful. I think Austria has some interesting experiences to offer in this respect. You may remember that the cooperatist Austrian system, based upon the so-called social partnership, used to be a model of successful economic policy, delivering good economic performance as well as low unemployment. This model went out of favor in the international debate for reasons most of you know much more better than me. Economists as well as politicians these days look to places like the United States or maybe New Zealand to get their new models. However, what happened in Austria was a transformation of the traditional model, step by step, and rather quietly delivering more of the flexibility needed to adjust to new economic conditions, yet without giving up the social dialogue. This process of transformation is by far not completed. It requires further efforts of fundamental reform. Yet I think there's sufficient reason to be optimistic that we will find the new solutions we are looking for. The Austrian economy is still performing remarkably well, despite the fact that the joining of the common market in 1995 brought huge requirements for structural adjustments. Currently, Austria still has the second lowest unemployment rate in the Union, the lowest rate of youth unemployment, and a high participation ratio. The Austrian labor market is in fact much more flexible than one would think of a system that, according to the theory, should only protect insiders. Wages are responsive to economic performance, with wage settlements below productivity increases in the last years. Even though the rate of unemployment is very low, there is a high turnover of unemployment. One out of almost every four people is affected by unemployment during the course of a year. Recently, even sacred cows, such as flexible working hours, are being slaughtered, and a harmonization of pension systems between the public and the private sector could be achieved. State intervention in the economy has been considerably reduced, without much ado and positive results for the recently privatized enterprises. And the reform of the vocational training system, a traditional competitive advantage of our economy, is currently underway. That politics of dialogue, I would call it, that politics of dialogue is still working, well, as well was demonstrated, when government deficits were reduced from forecasted 7% of GDP to 2.5% within the span of only 2 years, without creating the social tensions usually associated with such a process. Why do I tell you all this? Because I am arguing that reform is necessary if we want to find solutions for the problem of unemployment in Europe. And reform is possible, sometimes even without much hype, with a gradual transformation that builds on traditional strengths, as the Austrian example demonstrates. However, reform does require openness to new ideas, sometimes stepping over traditional ideological fences. Ideological fences, be they from the left or the right. My host here today, Anthony Giddens, was written a very thoughtful analysis on the shortcomings of the concepts of left and right in today's world. I will, of course, avoid any clumsy attempt to summarize or interpret your analysis, Professor Giddens. However, I would like to stress the importance of this approach in finding new solutions beyond the limits of traditional models. That means discarding the conservative spirit from the left that is opposed to any sort of change, protects insiders who have the good jobs and full benefits of an extensive welfare system against outsiders, who are in such a system easily relegated to second-class citizens. But it also means not falling into the trap of a new conservatism of the right, where deregulation only means cutting benefits for the workers, flexibility is always one-sided, and reduction in wages is regarded as the only possible solution for the problems of unemployment. What is needed is a new approach, recognizing that the world around us has changed. In designing employment policies, we have to understand that traditional forms of labor, such as the prototypical full-time male breadwinner, are no longer the norm. We have to change the rules and the structure of the welfare state, taking into account changing economic realities as well as changing individual lifestyles. We also have to change our attitude towards entrepreneurship. I say this very consciously as a social democrat. The old dividing lines between workers and employers no longer exist. And it is the new firms that create the jobs that we need. However, we have to be careful to still and provide security within change. And ever widening gap of income inequalities and the loss of social cohesion are unacceptable. We have to rebuild the welfare state, being responsive to new requirements, but we can't discard it. In all our actions, we have to ask ourselves, will it be good for the people? Will it improve social justice? And will it promote our future? Ladies and gentlemen, this is, of course, not an easy task. However, I think it is the task we have to complete if we are to speak of a people's Europe. And since both the British and the Austrian presidency will devote considerable effort to employment policies, I think we will be able to get a step ahead. As far as our own program is concerned, we will put special emphasis on the following issues. Intensifying the social dialogue at the European level. Reinforcing measures promoting equal opportunity, such as improving, for example, the compatibility of job and family for men and women, dominantly women. Giving a new impetus to economic growth, since this was the need for new jobs. Growth coming from innovation, growth coming from new products and new technologies, and from lifelong learning. The employment guidelines introduced at the Luxembourg summit were designed to promote policies reducing the rigidities in the labor markets. If those measures are put into place, there should also be more room for growth-oriented policies without leading to more inflation or giving up fiscal stability. Promoting also further harmonization, such as tax harmonization, to reduce harmful competition among countries for mobile capital. That is, in my opinion, in danger to result in a downward spiral of social standards and fiscal resources. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Monetary Union. There have been many comments on the irony that Britain will preside over the most important decisions regarding Monetary Union without participating herself. I don't think this is such a bad solution, since it may, in fact, serve its role as an honest broker much better without having its immediate interest at stake. Austria's situation is different. Monetary Union is not new for us. The Austrian Schilling has been pegged to the Deutschmark for over 15 years, and I think with positive effects. Inflation rates have been very low. The wage-setting process was long ago adjusted towards maintaining the peg. Structural change for export-oriented industries has been vigorous. And Austria has gained some economic leeway by registering a rate of productivity growth higher by around a half percentage point than Germany. Interest rate levels remained close or even below those of Germany. All in all, we see this mini experiment of a monetary union was a successful one. In our experience, it was not associated with the loss of sovereignty that the British seem to be concerned about. What will be the conditions for a larger monetary union to be as successful as well? The euro will have to establish itself in world financial markets as a strong, stability-oriented currency in order to obtain credibility in the markets. That means that the European Central Bank will have to conduct a prudent and stability-oriented monetary policy on a sustainable basis. It also implies that European macroeconomic policy will have to adjust successfully to its new regime. This involves coordination between the EMU members and coordination of EMU fiscal policy with that of pre-INS. And, as has been established at the Luxembourg Council, cooperation between EMU fiscal policy and the European Central Bank. What will the euro bring to the people? That may, at first sight, be harder to explain. However, I think several arguments can be made in this respect. First of all, on a very practical terms, a common currency will be a small one, but it will be a contribution to a common identity of Europe. Secondly, a common monetary and exchange rate policy will considerably increase the cooperation between countries, giving them a strong incentive to promote their common interest, since they no longer have the possibility to solve their adjustment problems through competitive devaluation. And finally, a common currency for such a large market should increase the stability of the international trade and financial system, thereby implicitly contributing to economic growth and employment. A successful EMU will propel the euro into a very strong position in terms of trade and financial transactions, exercising a stabilizing force. We Austrians hope that the EMU will be as wide as possible. Recent contacts with other heads of state and government confirm my conviction that we may agree in a large number of participants while fully safeguarding the future stability of the single currency. While EMU will undoubtedly go ahead, it is important not to generate a Europe at several speeds. Attempts will have been made from EMU itself, as well as from the pre-INS, in order to prevent new divergences because of EMU. I'm certainly in no position to offer any advice to the British government, but it is my sincere wish that conditions will permit the new government to join with us in EMU as soon as possible. Austria used to have problems with popular acceptance of a common currency as well. A currency is, of course, and especially in the situation of Austria after the Second World War, a currency is a part of national identity. But the Austrian government in the last months has launched a very extensive information initiative which increased approval ratings well above 60%. Ladies and gentlemen, a people's Europe doesn't merely address the peoples of the present Union, but those of a wider Europe. I don't think that we have to stress the fact that bordering on four of the candidate countries and having the longest frontier of all member countries, Austria has a very strong interest in the enlargement process. This is not just an economic interest, and it is also not an interest born out of some nostalgia for the re-establishment of Middle Europa, the Central Europe of former times. It is, in my opinion, an eminently political interest. Being neighbors and having had historical ties with Central European countries for centuries, we are convinced that a peaceful Europe will only be one without dividing lines. Therefore, for us, enlargement is first of all a political project. A project that should bring stability and put definite end to the Cold War. I have to admit that it was a very emotional moment for me last December in Luxembourg when the leaders of the 15 EU countries met for the first time with the leaders of the 11 countries that 10 years ago still suffered under communist dictatorship. And I'm very grateful to belong to the generation of European politicians who can now realize what our predecessors were not able to do. Enlargement is a project of removal of barriers. We know that there will be migration. And we know that an unchecked migration would produce considerable social tensions in our countries. Yet it is inconceivable to me that we put up new barriers to keep people out at the place where the Iron Curtain has been. The only reasonable policy to deal with migration, therefore, in my opinion, is to promote economic growth, allowing for an increase in the standard of living in the Central and Eastern European countries. Enlargement is also a project requiring inclusion. Inclusion means, of course, a sensible prospect for all European countries to eventually join the Union. In this context, I'm very frank and open, Austria has a strong interest in preventing an isolation of the Slovak Republic, not just because of our geographical proximity, but out of concern with political stability in Central Europe. I try to actively support this objective by promoting a trilateral dialogue between the Slovak, Hungarian and Austrian government. I am fully aware that the Slovak Republic does not yet confirm to the political Copenhagen criteria concerning democratic standards and human rights. But I am convinced that the incentives offered by the Union will help to reach these essential targets soon. Enlargement is, of course, also an economic project. Austria has already greatly benefited from the opening of the Central and Eastern European economies. Having had close trading relationships with these countries before transformation, Austrian companies were able to reinforce those relations with foreign direct investment. They were able to establish a stronger presence in this region than would actually correspond to the size of our economy. We expect further opportunities for our economy when the internal market will be extended to our neighbors. This overall positive economic perspective does, of course, not mean that there will not be the requirement for substantial structural adjustments on our part as well as that of the new candidates. Fears and resentments stemming from huge gaps in economic and social standards and structural imbalances may easily turn public opinion against the challenges of enlargement. It must be our major concern that the creation of a single Europe does not lead to even stronger social divides between the peoples of old and new members. Therefore, in our opinion, a careful preparation of the accession process is required, and there have to be sufficient adjustment periods before markets, in particular labor markets, can be opened completely. Institutional reform of the Union is, of course, a very important prerequisite of the enlargement process. However, I think enlargement will have the positive effect of acting as a catalyst to this reform, a reform which is necessary. Ladies and gentlemen, the European project is still a very imperfect one. A lot of critique about the process of integration is justified. There are still many problems to be solved, many deficiencies to be removed. Yet what has happened until now was a steady process of integration, a steady process to which, in my opinion, there is no alternative. No alternative if we want to achieve a peaceful and prosperous Europe. Thank you very much for your attention.
Chancellor Klingman said he'll take one or two questions if somebody would like to pose some from the audience, but we must finish sharp at 1 o'clock.
I could ask you to speak up. It's not very good. Is there a mic? I'm a student of the LSE and also corresponsal of Peruvian Financial Daily. I wanted to ask a question about the European Union and the several countries. You told about the importance of the social democratic influence in the European Union. Now, the Socialist Party in Spain is trying to put a motion to make sanctions on Peru because of the human records of Peru. I would like to know what will be your position in relation to sanctions to Peru on human rights issues, the relation between the European Union and Peru on questions of economic and political rights. That's all.
We collect two or three questions and then answer them all together.
Maybe it's more easier to answer very precise the sanctions of Peru.
I found your talk very interesting and very Austrian, the best way. But one of the things that you mentioned or did not mention about Austria is that Austria is a new country in Europe. It's one of three new countries. And what can Austria contribute as a new member and the first to take over the presidency?
You stress the need for Europe without borders. Could you tell us a little bit about your approach to NATO and Austria's possible membership of NATO?
Would you like just to answer?
Yeah, yeah. First of all, to the sanctions of Peru. I am not in detail informed now about the concrete problems, but I want to make it very clear. I think the European Union has the obligation to insist on human rights and democracy. And I understand and I supported the decisions of Luxembourg, especially in the case of Turkey, because today in Turkey we have political prisoners and torture. And therefore, in my opinion, it was necessary to separate Turkey from the other 11 countries being now candidates for membership, not taking away the European perspective for Turkey, but making it very clear that human rights and all the Copenhagen criteria are important for Europe. And we support the British presidency and Tony Blair especially, making this subject as a main topic of the British presidency. The second point, I think Austria, being a member of the European Economic Area, had really close, before the membership, had really close relations to Europe from economic point of view. And what we tried to add a strong belief to a unified, peaceful Europe. It is Austria's vision to realize this peaceful Europe because of our history, because of all the pain we had to live with. And we can offer, in my opinion, a high standard of environmental protection. And we hope that we can influence the European Union to stepwise achieve these high standards of environmental protection. Therefore, we support this idea of greening Europe. But not only in visions, not only in discussions, we want very concrete measures. For example, concrete measures to achieve an improvement of the modal split for transportation of goods, to bring it more to environmental friendly transportation systems, and to reduce the tremendous number of trucks crossing Austria from South Germany to North Italy and so on and so on. That means we, as Austrian politicians, know that it is necessary to have visions, but if we really want to improve the situation of the people, we have to realize these visions. That means we have to develop strategies and we have to develop concrete measures to realize these visions. And we hope that we have the support of the British presidency, for example, in a very important point, that the higher environmental standards in Austria, having a transition period until end of 98, could be achieved by the European community, and we are not forced to lower our better environmental standards. We hope that the environmental standards within the European Union could be improved to the level of the Austrian one. The second point, in my opinion, is we can really contribute a lot of experience in maintaining the social cohesion in a country. It is a very important value for Austria to avoid a society where, let's say, this social cohesion is destroyed. And therefore, we try to apply this new model of social dialogue with the social partners in Austria. The third point is, in my opinion, we can really contribute a lot of experience as a Central and Eastern European country. We have not only historical ties, we have also a lot of good relations, and not only economically, also cultural and personal, to the Central and Eastern European neighbor countries, and we have a lot of experience to make agreements and also new political ideas with these countries, and therefore I believe we can contribute a lot of that. And we hope that we can strengthen the democratic process in the European Union, because especially a small country is interested on a as good as possible democratic decision-making procedure. We sometimes do not really like it if a telephone call between France and Germany solves the problems. We accept that sometimes it's necessary, but and we understand that, and please understand you, that we are not perfectly happy if this dialogue is now widened to a trialogue. That means a telephone call between London, Paris, and Bonn solves the problem. We would support really a more democratic decision-making process where also smaller countries could discuss their interests within the European Union. The last question was about the transformation of the welfare state. I think in my opinion, we have to focus social transfers to people who need it. In Austria, we sometimes followed the political idea to maintain the political acceptance of social transfers, we have to give it all. We try, you understand what I mean? We try now to focus our social transfers to lower income groups, to lower income people, and that means not increase the money we can spend for social transfers, but have a better focusing on the people and the groups they really need it. And the second point is we try to achieve a balanced system. I give you an example. I became Minister of Finance January 96. The situation was a forecast of a budget deficit of 7%. And I had to develop measures to cut it down within 2 years to 2.5%. We also reduced the duration of subsidies for alone women in Austria from 2.5 year paid subsidies after maternity, after birth, to 1.5 year. And we did not increase the unemployment payments within the last 3 years. We stabilized it. And I think the reason why we could achieve social acceptance is that we balanced our measures, that everybody, and I hope really everybody in Austria, contributed his part as a lower income, a lower part as a higher income, a higher part to this consolidation program. It was, in my opinion, social balanced, and that was the reason for the acceptance. Just to give you one example, without changing the very attractive corporation tax rates, 34%, we have no specific taxes on assets and so on and so on. We could achieve 30 or 40% more income from the corporation tax by eliminating privileges and a lot of special allowances. In Austria, 2/3 of the companies didn't pay corporation taxes because of such a huge number of privileges and allowances. Huge banks, for example, didn't pay corporation taxes because of a very modular and flexible provision system and so on and so on and so on. And so on. I was in a former function CFO of a company, and all the tricks I used, I canceled as a Minister of Finance. sorry, the question on NATO on security policy. Maybe I can explain you first our situation now. Austria, because of our history, is a neutral country, not being part in the history of one of the blocs, the Warsaw Pact bloc or the NATO bloc. But we developed a lot of cooperation and solidarity. Austrian troops now are on the Golan Heights, Austrian troops are in Cyprus, Austrian troops are in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and so on and so on. We work very close together within Partnership for Peace, within the European Atlantic Partnership Council, within the OSCE, located in Austria, and within the United Nations. We think very carefully. If a membership of NATO now would bring more benefits to the security of Austria and Europe, or a good coordinated, close relation to NATO, together with his, let's say, independent status. For example, I remember I had a telephone call with Bill Clinton 1 week ago about this question. About the possibility sending Austrian experts to Baghdad. And the reason why there was a question of sending additional Austrian experts to Baghdad was not because our experts are so much better than other experts. The reason was we are seen as an, let's say, independent country. And yeah, and some months ago, I had a very interesting and important trip to Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, having previous contacts with Arafat and having previous contacts with Netanyahu. And in March, in some weeks, I'll go to the Middle East once more. I think it has an advantage for the international community that Austria can offer an a USP, a unique selling position in this way. It is not decided, because the Austrian government decided to make an report on several options on the end of March this year and to present it to the Austrian parliament. The options are status quo. The options are, for example, an improved participation in PFP Plus, and another option is the full membership to NATO. What we really believe, we believe in an European security architecture, and we accept the target, the objective of a European defense system with coordination with the Atlantic partners, it's clear. But the idea is, if for example, as it was discussed in Amsterdam, we could have an integration of WEU in EU. I know the British position is a different one, but nevertheless, if we Europeans are not ready to, for example, support peacekeeping activities in Bosnia without a decision in the Congress of the United States, we have to think about it. Today it is a fact. Today it is a fact. But we have to think about it if it is really the European feature, a future, or if we should think about the development of an organizational, technical structure to have as Europeans the chance and the will and the power to solve our local, regional, European crisis. What will be in Kosovo in some months from now? It was not really an acceptable situation that in Bosnia and Herzegovina we Europeans was not able to stay without the acceptance of the friends of the United States. It is no position against anybody. Really not. It is an idea what we Europeans really want to do in the future. And therefore I say we Austrians really believe that we have to improve, that we have to strengthen a European security architecture, and maybe that could be the right answer.
Everyone, please to stay in your seats until Chancellor Klima leaves. At the LSE, as everyone here will know, we get many visits from heads of government and heads of state. I hope you agree with me, this has been one of the very best and most inspiring, and I'd like to thank Chancellor Klima very, very much for coming. Thank you.